sun shines, Nelly, when the clouds go drifting by, we will be happy, Nelly, don't you cry.
Welcome to Ellery Queen's Mystery Magazine's fiction podcast. I'm EQMM's editor, Janet Hutchings. The author we feature this month is multi-talented. He's widely known for three series of novels that cover the private eye, police, and amateur sleuth genres. He's an Anthony and Derringer Award winner, and he also writes standalone thrillers and westerns. In addition, he's one of Mystery's most esteemed columnists, with a regular column entitled Blog Bites currently running in our magazine. If you are already an EQMM reader, you know that I'm talking about Bill Kreider. When we recorded this podcast, we discovered that Bill has yet another remarkable talent, which I'll tell you about after you've listened to his reading of his story, The Case of the Headless Man, from the March 1998 EQMM.
The Case of the Headless Man by Bill Kreider. Outside Bo Wagner's study, lightning ripped a white gold line through the inky sky, thunder rattled the windows. Rain hissed on the roof and washed across the window panes. Bo hardly noticed. All he heard was the clattering of the typewriter keys as he converted Janice Langtree's flowing script into black pica type on the white bond paper. Sam Fernando leaned languidly against the door frame and smiled. "So you believe that Scott Malone's death is a simple case of suicide, Detective Lomax?" The burly policeman shrugged. "Sure it is. Open and shut." Fernando raised his right eyebrow. "Then how do you explain this?" he asked, pointing to an innocuous-looking champagne cork that lay on the floor near the chair where Tipper Morgan had died. Bo stopped typing and pulled a pack of Camels and a matchbook from his shirt pocket. He lit up and exhaled with pleasure. He was glad Janice wasn't there. She always complained about his smoking. On the other hand, he didn't really mind the complaining, not as long as he could look at Janice, who was tall and blonde and built like a brick bathhouse. Look was all he could ever do, however. If he tried anything else, she'd give him a trip to the moon, the kind that Ralph Cramden always threatened Alice with. It was too bad she was bigger than he was. Thunder crashed again with the sound of someone falling down a distant attic stairway, but Bo didn't hear it. He was reading what he had just typed. He hated it when Sam Fernando, the gentleman sleuth, did that bit with his eyebrow. If Bo had been doing the writing, he'd have let Lomax rip the eyebrow off and stuff it down Fernando's throat, maybe knocking out a couple of pearly teeth in the process. But Bo wasn't the writer. That was Janice's job. Bo did the plotting and the typing. Janice did the writing. That was the agreement, and he supposed it was basically a good one, considering the fact that he couldn't spell any word of more than four letters without spending hours at the dictionary. He couldn't construct a decent sentence either. He didn't know a split infinitive from a dangling modifier, and frankly, he didn't care. He knew how to murder people with sewing needles, with belt buckles, and even with champagne corks, as Sam Fernando was just about to prove. Sam Fernando. Bo ground out his cigarette in the overflowing ashtray by the typewriter. Fernando was a sissy. If Bo had his way, Lomax would be the hero. Lomax or someone like him. Someone big, tough, and mean. Someone like Mike Hammer, who was featured in books that were currently outselling the Fernando books about 10-1. Janice didn't care about that. "I like refined men," she often told Bo, looking with distaste at a stain on his shirt or his pants. "So that's the kind of man I'm going to write about. Besides, our books are selling very well, thank you." Well, that last part was true. Sales certainly weren't anywhere near bad. But Bo would still have liked to write about a real man now and then. He brushed ashes off his wrinkled shirt and looked back at the manuscript. "You see, Detective Lomax, to the untrained eye such as yours, that cork appears to be perfectly normal. But I can see that it is not. If you will simply bend down and look more closely..." Bo might have tried to slip in something funny here. Maybe like having Lomax grab the cork and poke the supercilious Fernando in the eye with it. But Janice would never let him get away with it. Besides, he'd promised her he wouldn't change anything. That was the only reason she'd allowed him to finish the typing without her looking over his shoulder as she usually did. She had a cold and didn't feel like supervising him, so he'd made his promise and sent her home. The telephone rang just as thunder shook the house again. Bo forgot about the manuscript, mashed out his cigarette in the ashtray, and picked up the phone. The caller was Janice. "How's the typing going?" she asked in that soft Texas drawl that drove Bo wild with unrequited desire, even when it was obvious that the speaker had a stuffy nose. "Great," he said. "The gentleman sleuth is about to explain to Lomax about the champagne cork. How's the cold?" "Better. I had some chicken soup. Do you think you could take a break?" "Sure. Why?" "I was hoping you could come by and pick me up." Adrenaline shot through Bo's body so fast that it practically squirted out his fingertips. This was the call he'd been waiting for all his life. Janice with a cold was worth any three other women at the peak of health. 5 minutes. I'll be there in 5 minutes. Wait, four. I'll be there in 4 minutes. "Down, boy, down," Janice said. "If you don't stop panting like that, you're liable to step on your tongue." Bo forced himself to take a deep breath and let it out slowly. It wasn't easy. He'd never had a call from Janice like this one before. In fact, he couldn't remember her ever having called about anything but business. A sudden dark suspicion popped into his head. "Why did you phone me anyway?" he asked. "There's been a murder," she said. Bo felt the adrenaline again, but different this time. "What does that have to do with us?" "Lieutenant Franklin thinks we might be able to help out." Franklin was their police contact. Whenever Bo wanted to check on police procedure, he called Franklin, who was usually glad to help. To return the favor, Bo and Janice had helped him solve one of his recent cases. "Another locked room?" Bo asked. "I don't know about that, but there's sure something strange going on." "How do you mean?" "There's a witness. She saw a man running away from the scene of the crime." Bo was disappointed. "There's nothing strange about there being a witness." "Maybe not," Janice said, "but there was something strange about the man who was running." "Oh," Bo said, "and what was that?" Janice sneezed. Bo said, "Gesundheit." "Thanks. Don't mention it." "What was strange about the man who was running?" "He didn't have a head," Janice said. Bo Wagner was 35 years old, but as Janice often reminded him, he had never grown up, which was why they were zipping through the streets in a black chopped and channeled 49 Merc, and why Bo was wearing a red jacket just like the one James Dean had worn in Rebel Without a Cause. Ray Charles was belting out "What Did I Say" from a rear seat speaker that crackled every time there's a lightning flash. The windshield wipers tried to keep time with Ray and the Raylettes, but they were a little off. "You look great," Bo told Janice, cutting his eyes to the side. "I do not. My nose is red and my eyes are puffy, and you watch where you're going," she added, as Bo swerved to miss a car that had started to pull out of a side street. Bo honked the Merc's horn and resisted an urge to give the driver the high sign. He knew Janice wouldn't approve. "Tell me again about the headless guy," he said. "You know as much as I do. All the lieutenant told me was that somebody saw a man without a head running away from the house where a woman was murdered." "How was she murdered?" Bo asked. Janice took a tissue from her purse and sneezed into it. Then she said, "She was stabbed with a letter opener." "Crime of passion," Bo said. "The killer grabbed up the nearest handy weapon. Probably he was somebody who knew her." "It might have been an intruder," Janice said. The Chipmunks came on the radio singing Ragtime Cowboy Joe. Bo twisted the knob and turned the radio off. Something like The Witch Doctor was okay as a novelty song, but he drew the line at a bunch of singing chipmunks. "Intruders usually carry their own weapons with them," he said. "You wait and see. It'll be someone who knew her." "He ought to be easy to find then," Janice said, "him not having a head and all." Bo looked at the rain falling through the headlight beams. "It won't be as easy as you think," he said. The house where the murder had been committed was in an older section of the city, a long way from the residential area where Janice lived. The street was narrow and dark. The homes all dated from before the war and were solidly built of brick and wood. Most of them had concrete porches. It was easy to spot the one where the murder had occurred. The porch light was on and police cars lined the curb in front. Bo had to park nearly a block away. "I can see you brought your umbrella," he said. "Of course, didn't you?" Bo thought umbrellas were for sissies. Mike Hammer never used one. Of course, Hammer wore a hat and a trench coat, while all Bo had was his little red jacket. "I don't need an umbrella," Bo said. "The rain's letting up." They sat for a moment and listened to the rain pounding on the car's roof. "Sure it is," Janice said, "and a good thing, too, since this umbrella's too small for both of us." She opened the door on the passenger side and stepped out, opening the umbrella overhead as she did so. Bo sat for a second and watched her walk toward the house. He liked the way her blonde ponytail wiggled, and it made him think of a new song he liked, something by the Playmates about 5 feet of heaven in a ponytail. Of course, Janice was more like 6 feet of heaven, but as far as he was concerned, that just made things better. After 2 seconds of wishful thinking, Bo tore his eyes off the ponytail and got out of the car. He pulled his jacket up over his head and sprinted past Janice. He was on the porch brushing water off his sleeves when she arrived. She folded her umbrella and shook it, getting water on Bo. "Hey," he said, "watch what you're doing." "Sorry," Janice said, as if her mind was elsewhere. "I was thinking." Bo was about to make a smart remark about that when a uniformed cop stuck his head out the door and said, "Who are you?" "Bo Wagner and Janice Langtree," Bo told him. "Lieutenant Franklin asked us to come over." The cop gave him the once-over, clearly approving more of Janice than of Bo. Then he disappeared into the house and came back with Franklin and held the screen door open and said, "Come on in." He sounded as if he had a worse cold than Janice, but Bo knew that he didn't. Franklin's voice always sounded like that. The lieutenant led the riders into the back room of the house. The room looked to Bo like a sleeping porch that had been remodeled into a sort of narrow den. There was a Sylvania TV set on one wall with a couch opposite it. A telephone lay on the floor along with a TV guide and a National Geographic that apparently had fallen off a toppled end table near one arm of the couch. A dark-haired woman lay on a throw rug between the TV set and the couch. Her face was turned to the side, and Bo could see that she was young, maybe about 30. The throw rug was stained with her blood, and a gold letter opener protruded from between the woman's shoulder blades. Bo felt something lurch in his stomach. Looking at a real murder scene was a lot different from writing about a fictional one. Janice touched his arm, and he immediately tightened his stomach and squared his shoulders. He wouldn't want her to think he couldn't take it. "Betty Martin," Franklin was saying, "married, 29 years old, husband was away on a business trip, came back and found her like this." "How long ago?" Bo asked. He could see fingerprint powder on everything, and he knew the evidence gathering was already complete. Franklin looked at his watch. "About 2.5 hours. I called you two because you helped me out once before, and this one's pretty peculiar." "The man with no head?" Janice said. Franklin nodded. "Yeah. Woman across the street was looking out her window and saw somebody running away from this house just about the time the murder must have happened. She said he didn't have a head." "Any other witnesses confirm that?" Bo asked, as if he actually believed it. Franklin gave him a look, then said, "Not a one. It was raining pretty hard and there was nobody on the streets. Not that we've been able to find, anyway. And none of the other neighbors saw a thing." "So this woman across the street called the police to report that Ichabod Crane was running amok?" Bo asked. "Ichabod Crane had a head," Janice reminded him. "It was Brom Bones who pretended to be headless." Bo tried to raise an eyebrow the way Sam Fernando would have. He failed. "If you say so," he told Janice. "But am I right about the call?" "No," Franklin said. "You're wrong. It was the victim who made the call." The way Franklin explained it, Betty Martin hadn't actually called the police. She'd called her next-door neighbor, one James Fisher, to tell him that there was someone in her house. Janice gave Bo a look. "An intruder." "That's what Mrs. Martin said," Franklin told them. Fisher was a friend, and she asked him to come right over because someone was in the house. Fisher came over all right, but he called the station first. By the time he got here, the husband had arrived and was standing over the body. We got here not long after that. The husband was standing over the body, huh? Bo said. And how long had he been home? Franklin rubbed his potato-shaped nose. The husband's name is Gary, and he says he hadn't been here that long. He says he would have called us himself if Fisher hadn't already done it. He drove in from San Antonio. He sells sporting goods, and he'd been on the road for 2 weeks. And he's the primary suspect, right? Bo said. Crime of passion. Husband comes home, finds wife with lover, kills her, and lover gets away, open and shut. Just look for a guy with no head. He should be pretty easy to pick out of a lineup. Franklin snorted. He said, what about your intruder theory? There have been two or three burglaries in this neighborhood the past few weeks. I've talked to the patrolman for the area, and he thinks he knows who's behind them. A teenager named Tony Banks. They'll be bringing him in. I get it, Bo said. An intruder who didn't bring his own weapon. Probably just out for kicks, breaks in, gets surprised by the homeowner, and bingo, he stabs her with a letter opener. If Banks doesn't have a head, you're in like Flynn. Case closed. Franklin didn't appear to enjoy the idea of the headless man as much as Bo did. I wish it were that easy. Bo looked around the room. So what's the problem? No clues? Not a one so far, Franklin said, and don't start about the guy with no head again. I've about had it with the guy with no head. What about fingerprints, Janice said. There are plenty of those, Franklin said. Probably most of them belong to the murdered woman and her husband. But the killer wiped the handle of the letter opener and the telephone. Would a teenage intruder think about wiping prints? Bo asked. Everybody knows about stuff like that these days, Franklin said. TV. Could we talk to the neighbor? Janice asked. Franklin nodded. She's right across the street. Name's Frances Teague. You're kidding, Bo said. Frances Teague? That'd make her Fran Teague. Get it? Say it real fast. Fran Teague. Frantic. Great character name. We might be able to use that. Franklin wasn't impressed. This isn't some story with funny character names we're talking about here, Wagner. This is serious stuff. Sorry, Bo said. He's not really sorry, Janice said, glowering at him. But he will be if he doesn't watch it. Bo didn't like to have Janice angry with him. I'll watch it, he said. Let's go then, Janice said. Mrs. Teague's home wasn't much different from the Martins. The curtains were lacier, the floor was carpeted, and the furniture was older. That was about it. They were standing in the front bedroom, Janice holding the thin curtain aside and looking out the window. Mrs. Teague was beside her with Bo standing behind them. Was the Martins' porch light on when you looked out? Janice asked. Oh, no, Mrs. Teague said. She was short and thin with gray hair that lay close to her head in tight curls. There was just that street light up the block. Bo couldn't see the street light from where he stood, and it didn't give much illumination in the rain and darkness. Nothing more than faint streaks of light that thinned and faded into the shadows. Where'd the man go? Janice asked, straightening up. She was much taller than Mrs. Teague, who looked almost like a wizened child beside her. I couldn't tell, Mrs. Teague said. It was so dark that I wouldn't have seen him at all if there hadn't been a lightning flash. It was quite a surprise when I saw that his head was missing, let me tell you. Bo believed the last part, but he didn't think a lightning flash would have improved visibility very much. Did he turn to the right or to the left? Janice asked. Could you tell? Yes, when I saw him, he stepped off the porch and turned to the right. To my right, that is. It would have been to his left, of course. And that was all I saw, really. After the flash, it was dark again. Was he a big man or a small man? Bo asks. Just average. About your size. Bo wasn't sure just how to take that. While he was thinking about it, Janice asked, Were you looking out the window? Did you hear something? I was looking for Prissy, Mrs. Teague said. I couldn't find her, and sometimes she sits in the window. Who's Prissy? Bo asked. She's a cat, Mrs. Teague informed him. I have three cats, Prissy, Missy, and Sissy. Bo opened his mouth to say something, but a look from Janice shut him up. Sissy and Missy are afraid of storms, Mrs. Teague went on, but not Prissy. She likes to sit in the window and watch the rain. She wasn't there, though. I found her later in the kitchen, eating. Is that where she is now? Bo asked. Oh, no. She and the other girls are in the back room. They all have beds there. Of course, Bo said. How well did you know the Martins and Mr. Fisher? Janice asked, getting things back on track. Mrs. Teague looked down at the floor. Oh, they were very nice neighbors. Bo knew an evasion when he heard it. Did the Martins ever argue? Mrs. Teague looked embarrassed. Well, sometimes. I could hear them yelling. Bo was sure that Franklin had already asked these same questions, but he said, What about fighting? Did they ever fight? Oh, no, just loud arguments sometimes. Everybody argues. What did they argue about? Janice asked. Mrs. Teague drew herself up to her full height, which Bo estimated at 5'0". I'm sure I wouldn't know. What about Fisher? Bo asked. Is he married? No, he's a bachelor. She used the same tone she might have used in informing them that Fisher was a white slaver. Nothing wrong with bachelors, Bo said defensively. Both Janice and Mrs. Teague looked at him. An uncomfortable silence gathered in the room. Did he ever visit Mrs. Martin? Bo asked. I'm sure I wouldn't know about that, Mrs. Teague said in a tone that led Bo to believe that she knew very well, but that she wasn't about to tell. He had a feeling that she looked out her front window a lot more often than she was letting on, and that she wasn't looking for Prissy all the time either. Well, I guess that about does it then, Bo said. Thanks for all your help, Mrs. Teague. Janice added her own thanks, and the two of them left. When they were outside, Bo shivered. Three cats, he said. Can you imagine it? I like cats, Janice said. Hey, me too, Bo said a little too quickly. I was just thinking how nice it would be to have three of them, that's all. I bet you were, Janice said, and sneezed. When they got back to the Martins, Franklin was in the living room talking quietly to a boy dressed in faded jeans and a light jacket, a lot like the one Bo was wearing. Probably Tony Banks, Bo thought. Too bad he has a head. The boy looked very young, not more than 15. His dark hair was combed into an admirable ducktail. Franklin saw Bo and Janice come into the room and motioned for them to join him. He introduced them to Tony, who looked at them shyly with dark brown eyes that didn't stay still for very long. He seemed too frail to have plunged a letter opener into anyone's bag. Tony tells me that he's been a naughty boy, Franklin said. The boy twisted his hands together nervously. He didn't look much like a burglar to Bo. He's broken into a couple of houses around here, Franklin said. But he says he's never hurt anybody. That's right, Tony said. His voice was soft as his shifty eyes. I just take things sometimes, that's all. Bo was about to ask him what he took when a man burst into the room with a cop right behind him. Is this the kid who killed her? The man yelled, reaching out for Tony, who ducked behind Franklin. Let me have him for 5 minutes, just five. Franklin put a hand on the man's chest. Hold on, Mr. Martin. We don't know that Tony did anything. Franklin wouldn't have been able to stop Martin if he were really angry, Bo thought, because Martin was really huge. It was a good thing the other cop came up behind Martin, ready to put the arm on him if necessary. Not that Bo wouldn't have jumped right in if needed, but fortunately he wasn't. The little juvenile delinquent killed my wife, Martin said, reaching around Franklin for the boy. I heard you talking. I know he was here. Tony didn't seem afraid of Martin in the least, just a little nervous. I was here, but I didn't come in. Like I told the lieutenant, I just checked the back door and it was locked. I never break in anywhere. Just go in if the door's open. Is that right, Lieutenant, about the door being locked? That's right, Franklin said, bolted from the inside. So nobody went out that way. Not after Mrs. Martin died, Franklin said. Which leaves us with the headless man, Bo said. That's right, Franklin agreed. He didn't look happy about it. And now, if Mr. Martin will just go back in the other room, we'll finish talking to Tony. What about Fisher? Janice asked. Is he here? Franklin inclined his head in the direction Martin was going, led by the other cop, who had a firm grip on his arm. He's in there. He's pretty shook up over this. That Mr. Martin's pretty shook up too, Bo said, and he's a big guy, big enough to stick the letter opener right through his wife if he wanted to. He's got the temper for it, too. You're forgetting that he didn't have a reason to kill his wife, Janice said, and you're leaving out the headless man. Beau pretended to be hurt. Who's the plotter here, you or me? You write the words, but I'm the one who comes up with the plot. Maybe so, but you're still leaving all that out. Franklin held up a hand. Obviously, he didn't want to get started on the headless man again. Won't we go back to Tony here and see what he has to say? Before you came in, he was telling me about how he tried the back door of this house. Go over that again, Tony. Tony twisted his hands together and began talking, but Beau wasn't really listening. He thought he had things pretty well worked out by now. Gary Martin was a traveling salesman, after all, and while Beau knew better than to believe that most of the old jokes about the profession were true, there was a factual basis for them. Salesmen spent a lot of time on the road, and now and then they'd been known to stray from the straight and narrow, which was only to be expected. A man had certain urges. But what about a man's wife? Beau knew all about the old double standard. What was all right for a man wasn't considered acceptable behavior for a woman. The way Beau figured it, Betty Martin had been playing around with James Fisher while her husband was out of town. Gary came home but hadn't announced himself for some reason or other. His wife heard him, called Fisher, who arrived too late. By the time he got there, Gary had confronted his wife about her affair and killed her. Satisfied that he had the right answer, Beau motioned for Janice to follow him to the porch. All right if I smoke, he asked when they were outside. Only if you stand far away from me, she said. Beau put the pack of Camels back in his shirt pocket and explained his theory. Janice agreed that Fisher and Betty Martin probably had a thing going. Mrs. Teague practically admitted as much. But I don't think Mr. Martin killed his wife. Why not? You're forgetting about the man with no head. He doesn't exist, you know that. Everybody has a head. Not everybody, Janice said. They were in the Martin's kitchen. The table had a yellow formica top, and the chairs were made of tubular steel and had vinyl seats that were nearly the same color as the tabletop. Beau didn't want to sit in them. Vinyl made him sweat. Janice was sitting in one chair with Franklin, Martin, and Fisher in the other three. I still think it was the kid, Martin said. He's lying. I know he was lying. He was in this house tonight. That's what Betty heard. I'm sure of it. I think you're wrong about that, Janice said. The boy might be a burglar, probably is a burglar, but he didn't kill your wife. Who did, then, Martin said, and don't look at me like that. I certainly didn't kill her. Let Miss Langtry talk, Franklin said. She's pretty smart about stuff like this. Thank you, Lieutenant, Janice said. She blew her nose delicately into a tissue and continued. Two things are the key to this puzzle, the telephone and the man with no head. That's the most ridiculous thing I ever heard, Fisher said, speaking for the first time. That old woman across the street is crazy. She's a busybody, too, but mostly she's crazy. There's no such thing as a headless man. Maybe not, Janice said, but there might be something that looked like a headless man. I saw something like that tonight. When? Beau asked. Everybody looked at him as if they'd forgotten he was in the room. Maybe they had. When you were running toward the porch right after we got here, Janice said. You're like most men. You don't like to carry an umbrella. But you don't like getting your hair wet either. So you pulled your jacket up over your head. From a distance, on a dark night, you might look a little like a headless man. Beau had to admit she was right, but he didn't know what that proved, so he asked her. Nothing. But the man Mrs. Teague saw was running in the direction of Mr. Fisher's house. Fisher stood up. I'm leaving now. I've heard enough of this. Franklin put a heavy hand on his arm and pulled him back to his chair. Sit down, Fisher. You're not going anywhere. Not till Miss Langtry finishes talking. Go ahead, Miss Langtry. Well, I'm pretty sure if we ask her the right way, Mrs. Teague will tell us that Mr. Fisher used to visit here a lot when Mr. Martin was out of town. Beau grinned. He'd been right about that part. Martin didn't grin. He half jumped across the table, his hands reaching for Fisher, who shoved his chair away. Franklin stood up and grabbed Martin's collar. Calm down, Franklin said. Beau put his foot against the back of Fisher's chair and pushed it back to the table. Fisher's shoes squeaked on the slick floor. Janice went on this time as if she hadn't even been interrupted. The other thing was the telephone. I wondered why it had been wiped clean. A burglar wouldn't do that because a burglar wouldn't use the phone. But Mr. Fisher might. Now see here, Fisher said, standing again. I'm getting real tired of telling you to sit down, Franklin said. But why would I use the telephone here, Fisher asked as he sat back in his chair. If I'd been here, that is. You'd use it to call your house, Janice said, after you killed Mrs. Martin. But I didn't kill her, Fisher said. She called me and told me that there was someone in her house. I was the one who found the body. Bo got it then, the perfect alibi. But what if you were the one who made the call? You could have lied about it. But you were afraid the police might be able to get the phone records and find out there was really a call made from this number to yours, so you made sure there was. Of course, then you had to wipe your prints off the phone. By golly, Janice. Bo didn't get to finish the sentence. This time, Martin made it all the way across the table and got his fingers locked around Fisher's neck. It took Bo and Franklin both to pry the fingers loose, and by the time they did, Fisher was gagging desperately for air. Franklin put the handcuffs on Martin. What are you doing that for? Bo asked. Fisher's your headless man. Yeah, Franklin said, sort of. And Martin's going to make it for real if I don't do something about him. He looked at Janice. That was pretty smart figuring. Thanks, Janice said, just before she sneezed. Franklin was right, Bo told Janice as they drove toward her house. That was pretty smart. I don't know why I didn't get it first, though. You didn't see yourself running up to the porch with your jacket over your head. Right, Bo said, wishing he were convinced. You think Fisher will confess? Franklin doesn't have any evidence, just what you figured out. I wouldn't worry about that, Janice said. Now that he knows who did it, Lieutenant Franklin will find the evidence. That wet jacket will be in Fisher's house, along with some wet shoes. Whatever clothes Fisher was wearing will be there too, and there might be blood on them. Even if he washed them, blood's hard to get out. She paused. And then there's Tony. Tony? Bo said. Sure, he was around that house just about the time of the murder. You saw the way he was looking so shifty-eyed all the time. He knows something he's not telling. I bet he saw Fisher leave, or maybe he saw something while he was at the back door. What about a motive? Bo asked. That's going to be important at the trial. Shouldn't be hard to find one either, Janice told him. My guess is that Mrs. Martin was going to end the affair. Either that or she was going to tell her husband about it. You saw what he was like. Fisher couldn't very well have let her tell. Lieutenant Franklin will get it out of him. You really got it all figured, Bo said. Janice just nodded, and they listened to the radio for a few minutes. Phil Phillips was singing Bo's current favorite slow song, Sea of Love. I'd sure like to dance to that one, Bo told Janice. I've got a cold, Janice reminded him. I don't feel like dancing. I meant when you were feeling better. You smell like cigarettes. Bo's heart sank. He loved smoking. He loved the taste of the smoke and the way it bit into his lungs. He loved the way it gave him something to do with his hands, and he loved the way smoke hung in the air when he breathed it out into the room. On the other hand, at least she hadn't said he was too short. There wasn't anything he could do about that. What if I quit? He asked. Janice looked out through the windshield. We'll see, she said.
On a Sunday morn sat a maid forlorn with her sweetheart by her side. Through the window pane she looked at the rain. We must stay home, Joe, she cried.
The Case of the Headless Man is copyrighted by Bill Kreider, who is also a member of The Next Edition, the barbershop quartet you heard at the beginning and end of this podcast. I believe this is the first time the Texas author's talent as a singer has been revealed to his fans in the mystery community. He sings lead in the classic Rainy Day song chosen to accompany this podcast's story, Wait Till the Sun Shines, Nellie. Joining Bill in The Next Edition's rendition of the song are Ed Luby, tenor, Gary Logsdon, bass, and Richard Wolf, baritone. The instrumental version of the song is performed on all instruments by the author's son, Alan Crider. Mixing for this podcast was done by Emily Giuliano. You can subscribe to Ellery Queen's Mystery Magazine, where you'll find more suspenseful stories like this one by visiting our website at www.themysteryplace.com/EQMM.